Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet. Eric Smith filling in for Bob McCowan, John Shannon here till the top of the hour. Later on this hour, we'll talk about, one of the greats. How great? We'll find out from Nigel Reed, host of the Soccer Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, as David Beckham is deciding to hang it up after two more games, he will step away from his playing career.
Fascinating. It's a week after Alex Ferguson.
Fascinating.
Well, and just, they had a real separation at one point when they were at Manchester United. And did he wait until Alex Ferguson left so that he could retire too?
Well, and maybe just let him have his time in the sun
so that he
could make sure he got his headlines as well. We'll also talk more about the National Hockey League postseason.
By the way, Rafi Torres, the verdict still is not down. We do expect it before the game tonight in Los Angeles. And if it comes down before 7 o'clock, you will hear it here.
And we will get it to you right away, and we can also maybe get the opinion right now on this matter from a guy who knows the game better than most and very familiar with this territory. You've heard him on the station a ton of times, former player, former coach, working for NBC Sports, Eddie Olczyk. Eddie, thanks for the time tonight.
How are you, Eric? John, how are you guys doing?
Good. Oh, how are you?
Doing great. Doing excellent. Good time of year.
Yeah,
great
I know. Now last night, I love watching games from the United Center.
Yeah.
Last night had to be one of the dullest games I've ever seen. Was it me or was it just that blanket that Joel's team put over the Red Wings?
Well, it's probably a combination, to be honest with you. I mean, it didn't seem, even Doc Emmerich made mention that it was a very, the crowd was very timid. There wasn't a lot of animosity coming from the United Center fans down to the ice, and it was just one of those games where I thought Detroit had the better play overall in the totality of the first period. Chicago got off to a great start, John, and then for 7-8 minutes, and I thought Detroit took it to them in the rest of the first, but second and third period, it was downhill. I mean, it was all Chicago, and eventually got a few goals past Jimmy Howard, who I thought played pretty darn well, so I think the crowd had probably more to do with it than the actual game itself, because I think both teams had quality chances, and a bunch of times, I think three or four times, Detroit tried to pass the puck instead of shoot it. And I remember one play in particular, Danny Cleary had the puck, there's nobody in between him and Corey Crawford, and tried to make a pass instead of just taking the puck right to the net. So maybe it's the first game of the series for Detroit. You know, they just hit a wall physically, and it's what it was, but I can't argue with your assessment.
Eddie, is that the kind of game, you kind of just touched on this a little bit towards the end there, that can set the tone early on in game one to kind of roll that through the rest of the series? Or to your point, was it maybe just a game, the first game for Detroit, and you see a better bounce back in game two?
Yeah, I would expect a huge pushback, a little bit longer duration, Eric, for the Red Wings. And you think about it, you come off a seven-game series, and more times than not, and John, you can speak to this because you've been in those meetings when scheduling happens, and now we know that we've always known that TV dictates, but much more so now than it did 15, 20 years ago. When you play a seven-game series, you're usually punished at some point because of the schedule. You play every other night, more times than not, back in the day. Now, you look at what happened. They played that game was Sunday night, right, in Anaheim. So they traveled home Monday. They practiced Tuesday. They played in Chicago Wednesday. They go back home last night because they got 2 days in between. Then they go back home, play Monday, and then they don't play again for two more days on Thursday for game four. So a huge break I would anticipate for a team like Detroit or any team that comes off a seven-game series, and especially a hard series like the series against Anaheim. The physical toll, the travel certainly plays a part into it. But Detroit's a cagey team. Mike Babcock has done an unbelievable job there with not a lot when you look at the collectiveness of their team, especially on the back end. I think he's done a masterful job at getting this much and being a team like Anaheim. So I would expect them to have a huge pushback and come back way better in game two, just like in round one, where they weren't very good in game one. And they came back and had a huge win in game two. So I think that there's some things to build on, and I think a lot of it would have to be psychological for Coach Babcock and his staff to say, hey, yeah, we had a tough series, travel, we played well for the first period, and then we just collectively, mentally, physically lost it for two periods. It's a seven-game series, and we need to bounce back. So I would imagine that would be the approach by Coach Babcock.
The Blackhawks have won 5 of 6 games they've played. Has Joel been happy yet? No, seriously. But you know what I mean.
I'm going to just tell you. I think the second and third period of last night's game for sure, and the start of the game. Other than that, dissect coach speak from Coach Q. Trying to find that game, that pace he talks about, playing with more direction, playing more straight ahead. For the 5-game series against Minnesota in round one, there were periods and stretches, John, that were, I think, he was happy about. But look, I really believe that if you play somebody else in the first round, that's, you know, we're talking about teams available in the playoffs, I think that series goes 7 games in the first round. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, I asked a couple of players, and I said, give me on a scale of 1 to 10, where you think your team played collectively, 10 being the best and 1 being obviously very poor. I said, just give me a number, what you think. And 1 said 5, 1 said 6, so we'll cut it right in the middle. And if you play like that more times than not in the playoffs, you're not going to have success. And then they played a strong game, a bounce back game last night with the start, and then obviously the last 2 periods.
The Blackhawks made 1 lineup change last night, 1 noticeable one. David Boland came back to the lineup, and that really does change the personality of the team, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, it gives Joel Quenneville somebody that takes his game to another level in the playoffs. There's no question about it that David Boland is that type of player when it comes to playoff performance, and it gives him more options at the center ice position. It gives them more options when you talk about the ability to be able to move lines around, give guys a little bit of a breather every once in a while. He performed really well for a guy that missed the whole first round of the playoffs and quite a few games toward the end of the regular season. So David Boland is a guy that gets by in the regular season. You expect more, you want more, but it's what he is in the regular season. But there's something for money hockey, and David Boland's a guy that raises his level. So when you're healthy and you have a full complement of players as a coach, you love it because it makes decisions really hard, and some guys got to sit out. And that certainly takes place now with David Boland back and the type of lineup that Joel Quenneville wants to play, whether he wants to use Michael Hanzus in that second-line center position with Patrick Kane and Patrick Sharp, or move a guy like Daniel Carcillo in and out of the lineup, and right now it's Victor Stahlberg who's on the outside looking in because of the decisions by Joel Quenneville.
Well, you beat me to it in talking about Stahlberg. Stahlberg would have taken note of last night's victory. Do you expect him? Will he get another chance in this series, do you think?
Yeah, you know what? As you know, John, you need everybody. And whether you're a role player like Victor Stahlberg or a guy like Jamal Mayers or Sheldon Brookbank, you know, everybody wants to play, everybody wants to contribute, but you got to be ready when your number's called. And for Victor Stahlberg, I thought he really emerged this year as a better all-around player, John. I thought that he really took his game to another level and proved that he could be a consistent third-line player in the National Hockey League. And there's nothing wrong with that. He got an opportunity to play on a power play all season long. He 47 games he played. He pretty much played on the majority of the power play, whether it was 1 unit coming out, second, really didn't matter. He had 2 assists all year on the power play, and came time for the playoffs, and his role changed, where he got no power play time in round one, 57, 58 seconds a token, throw kill the clock and get off the ice type of power play. But he was on that third line with Shaw and Bickle in the first round, and remember, Stahlberg made the great play to Bickle to win game one in overtime. Yeah. Against Minnesota, that line I thought was consistent. Yeah, they had some really good shifts and some good territorial play, but there were some times where they struggled. But, you know, a lot of players have that. And for Victor Stahlberg, I don't think it's any one thing. I think you look at the coaching aspect of it and decisions and what do you want. You want centermen in the lineup. You know, you want a little bit more experience there. And that's just the way it is. But let's call a spade a spade. Last 16 playoff games for Victor Stahlberg, no goals. And somehow, some way, you got to contribute other than just your speed and what have you. So I think people are trying to read into a lot on why he didn't play one thing. Look, there's a lot of things as far as what I can see. But at the end of the day, the last 16 games without scoring a goal, maybe you should look there and then start, you know, following the dominoes that fall after that.
Speaking with Eddie Olczyk from NBC Sports. Eddie, switching gears, game one tonight between Boston and New York. If you're Claude Julien and you're in that locker room looking at your team, you're thrilled about their comeback in game seven against the Leafs. Are you concerned at all about your goal scoring over the last three games outside of the final minute and 25 seconds, you know, with an extra attacker against the Leafs, especially staring down the barrel of Henrik Lundqvist and two straight shutouts of the Caps in game six and seven?
Yeah. If they were playing somebody else, Eric, I would say yes. But I would anticipate these games all to be 2-1 or 1-0. That's just the way it's going to be. I mean, Lundqvist to me is the best goaltender in the National Hockey League and the best goaltender in the world, if you want to throw that out there. The way the Bruins play, you're right, they do have a tough time generating. They do have a tough time finishing. The Rangers are no different. And chances are going to be there, but they're not going to be there as much because of the way that both these teams play. I think the biggest, the motivation or the coach to player dialogue on the Boston side, Eric, would be, if I had that opportunity, would be, look, we want to pound the defense of the New York Rangers. They came off a long series where there was a physical series. Every time Ryan McDonagh, Dan Girardi, Anton Strowman are on the ice, we want to make life really, really difficult for them. And the Bruins have that ability to be able to do it. And we saw how they played in a lot of those periods and stretches against the Leafs. That's the way that they have to play, and that's how they're going to be able to have success. So the goal scoring, I think, is always going to be an issue, the inconsistency. But to me, I think, like I said, low scoring. They have the ability. They're comfortable in playing 1-0, 2-1 games. And you know, I don't know the status of Mark Stahl. To me, he really ends up being the wild card, I believe, in the series and in the success or lack thereof of the Rangers have moving forward. I mean, because now all of a sudden you look at McDonagh, Girardi, Stahl, and I know he's only played one game in the last, whatever, six, seven, 8 weeks, whatever it is, but to me, he really is a difference maker and takes the Rangers from being a good defensive team to an outstanding defensive team. And that's a lot of weight to put on the shoulders of a guy that is coming back from an eye injury and whatever other stuff he's suffering from. But I expect a very low scoring series. And if I'm the Bruins, I make it as physically as you can and pick your spots on those guys. They're going to play a lot of minutes. And look, the Bruins are banged up too on the back end.
Yeah.
So I'm sure the Rangers are thinking about playing that way too. And it should be a great series, and I couldn't be happier to see another original six matchup in the playoffs.
Yeah, former Leaf saying he couldn't be happier with that original six matchup. That's good, Ed. hey,
and
no,
and the Rangers and the Blackhawks.
I know, Eddie. Yeah, I know. But you talked about banged up guys. I mean, the Bruins are really going to miss Dennis Seidenberg.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff he does that he doesn't get credit for when he's on the ice with Chara.
Yeah, well, he's a player that he takes up a lot of space. He defends extremely well. You can play him with a young guy like Bartkowski or Dougie Hamilton, or go ahead and know that at the end of the period or the end of a game, you can put him out there with Big Z. And I mean, those are losses of huge magnitude. But that's why it's a team. That's why you carry extra guys. That's why you have these guys ready to go. And that's the one thing. And I was lucky enough to be a part of a few teams that had this philosophy. And you know, my situation in coaching in Pittsburgh was a little different because of the situation we were in when we pretty much, you know, started from scratch and were moving forward. Is that you've got to have the ability over the course of a regular season, and I know this year was different with the 48-game regular season, but to be able to trust and play some of those young guys, like Dougie Hamilton played quite a bit for long stretches in the regular season. You might need him at some point to be a go-to guy because of this reason, and that seasoning that player gets at the National Hockey League level is so valuable moving forward, could end up being the difference for you guys of winning a round and going home early. And for the Bruins right now, with the guys that they got banged up on the back end, you're going to count on Hamilton. You're going to count on Bartkowski. those guys have had some cracks, but I think the philosophy of making sure they did get their reps in the regular season will help them adapt in the confidence level of the coaching staff to be able to play them in those situations. I think that's just absolutely gigantic when you get into a situation like this.
I can tell you, Dougie Hamel did not embarrass himself in Game 6 and 7 against the Maple Leafs. And he,
somehow you got to find that comfort, that level. And you may be a, you know, an offensive guy, John. You've seen it for a thousand years. You may be an offensive type of player, especially when you're a young guy. That may be your greatest strength. But sometimes, you know what? Off the glass and in the middle of the ice is okay when you're a young player come Stanley Cup playoff hockey, because there's no better challenge, there's no better competition than the Stanley Cup, going for the greatest trophy in all of sports, playing in front of the greatest fans that we have. Is that there is a different dimension to it, so less is more, and he did. He grew up a lot, and I think he gains confidence off this. Now the stakes are higher. Now how does the player react? Then if you know you have the belief of the coaching staff and the trust as a young player, you're going to skate through a wall for everybody if you know that they trust you. And for the Bruins, they have to trust their young D-man because they don't have a lot of other guys to count on. I don't see Mike Milbury or Ray Bourque coming out of the stands to save the Bruins in this series.
Well, Milbury would try, but
skates in hand, I will say. Skates in hand.
Eddie, let me just ask you quickly before we fly, waiting for Game 2 with the Sharks and Kings, and it's been the topic, yeah, obviously, for the last number of days. We're still awaiting word, hopefully in the next 20, 30 minutes, maybe. Regarding Torres, what do you think Brendan Shanahan and the league ultimately decide with Torres?
Well, let me just say this. I'm not sure what they're going to do. To me, I would not give him anything. When I watch that play and I see the play develop and I see Jared Stoll, and I hope he's okay, and I don't like to see any of our guys get banged up ever, is that when you see him change the level of the play developing, it's almost impossible for any player to adjust that type of a play on a less than a split second. And I want to give all players the benefit of the doubt, and some have that reputation, and Rafi Torres is certainly at the top of that list when you talk about it. But to me, I look at that hit and I go, well, what about the hit that Ovechkin put on Ryan McDonagh in Game 7, where it was a very similar play, but it was near the boards and it was in the corner, and hands were up, and he just drills Ryan McDonagh in the side of the head into the end boards, and, you know, there was nothing called, which is okay. I mean, that's the way that it is, but I know it's a different type of play, but when a player changes his level, that's what makes it so difficult for the league and so difficult for the referees, because things happen so quick, especially on the ice. But to me, if you want to call a charge, I don't know if I call it a charge on the ice.
Right.
But to me, reputation got him the penalty in the game, and reputation got him the hearing. But to me, from what I saw, the level changed, and I think that's where it became an even playing field when you talk about arguing on both sides. So, long-winded, I would not give Rafi Torres anything for that particular play.
Okay, most important question of the interview, Eddie. Can Orb win the Preakness?
Can Orb win? Well, yes, he can, but I think that he's going to have to maneuver himself coming out of the number one position, and I'm hoping that one of my horses can get a jump on him, Turner for Home. Let me say this: if he gets the lead, Turner for Home, you're not beating him, because he's like Wayne Gretzky, Michael Jordan. When they got the lead, you're not taking those guys down. So the key is for somebody to get a jump on him, Turner for Home. I like the number four horse. I like the Parting. I think he might get the jump on him. I don't know if he can beat him, and I'm hoping that he can, but Orb looks like a real deal, and it'd be great to see a horse going for the Triple Crown again, and hopefully he can stay healthy. But getting my feet wet, I'm going to look for Departing to beat Orb.
I can spend $2 bets then, one on the number four and one on Orb. That's good.
You can box them up if you want, John.
Oh, it's too confusing for us. You've confused me now, Eddie.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, you can. Hey, no, wait a second. you head over to Woodbine. You got beautiful people there. They got a great facility. You just go tell them, I like the box, orb, and departing. And exact the box. You spend some of that money. I mean, get off your wallet, spend $20, and then you might get back $200, $300. I mean, then you can buy dinner for the first time, right?
For the first time.
And I'm assuming you'd expect an invitation, too.
No, I would not. Just take Eric and take Ryan out, and then send Bob the bill.
Hey, Eddie, appreciate the time as always. Thanks for doing this.
All right, guys. Great being with you, John. Talk to you soon, buddy.
Always.
There is Eddie Olczyk from NBC Sports, and always good to hear from him. You know what? He probably could get a gig with NBC Sports working on. I mean, if Brad Doherty can work with ESPN on NASCAR, we can get Eddie Olczyk's working some horses and work with Pugins.
Well, he will inevitably end up on one of their races at some point. I guarantee you.
All right.
At some point.
Well,
he's
call some people. You know a couple people.
Yeah, they don't like me.
When we continue on Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network simulcast here on Sportsnet, we will look at a situation that. Well, initially impacted the NBA and a potential move of a franchise to Seattle, but the ripple effects may be felt in the National Hockey League as well. That's up next, Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet. Welcome back to Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet. Eric Smith in for Bob McCowan, John Shannon co-hosting. And John, we've got breaking news with Rafi Torres.
Rafi Torres has been suspended for the remainder of the Kings Shark series. So obviously there is no long-term ramification. It's six games maximum. But if the Kings win in four, then he's lost for three more games. So he flew to New York today, had the hearing with Brendan Shanahan and his people this afternoon, and I assume he's back on a plane back on the way to Los Angeles, but he will not play against the LA Kings for the remainder of the second round.
Just very quickly here, we're going to talk to Tim Booth in a couple of moments in Seattle, but we just finished, not 5 minutes ago, asking Eddie Olczyk about his opinion. He said if he were in charge, he would have ruled no games, no suspension.
Right.
I saw your reaction. Mine was similar and kind of surprised that Eddie said that. It's kind of been sort of on the fence, depending on who you are. Why do you feel that this is justified, or would you have gone less games, more games, same amount?
He's right about reputation. There's no question. These are my words. They view Rafi Torres as a predator. They have already suspended him once for 21 games. They feel that this hit, they're trying to get out of the game. There is a rule in the rule book, Rule 48, that is supposed to take this out of the game. They need to try a way to enforce it. Anybody else, and I think they'd already set this up, really, that anybody else, two or three games. Rafi Torres, maximum of six.
Well, there you go. So Rafi Torres out for the series against the Los Angeles Kings. So it's, as John said, six games maximum. And if San Jose is eliminated, well, that ends the suspension right there anyway. So we'll see how that impacts the Sharks as they get set for Game 2 of their series against the Kings going tonight. A soap opera, a drama, a saga that's been unfolding for months now, predominantly in the National Basketball Association, but its ripple effects perhaps felt in the National Hockey League and in sports in general with the impact that it could have had and arguably still could have on the city of Seattle and their sporting culture. Was the fact that it was just announced over the course of the last 24 hours that the NBA Board of Governors is keeping the Sacramento Kings in Sacramento. The Kings will have the opportunity to have a new arena in Sacramento, which could, hopefully should, revitalize, rejuvenate that city, that fan base in general. But obviously Seattle is left without a team and perhaps without the new arena that was going to be built and the return of an NBA franchise to that market and perhaps an NHL team that may have come down the pike as well. Joining us on the line right now to talk about that from Associated Press in Seattle, Tim Booth. Tim, thanks for the time tonight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Tim, I struggled to come up with the word soap opera, saga, drama. It seems like they all apply as Seattle was getting a team, then they weren't. Then they were, then they weren't. This has been back and forth, and they've sort of been left holding on to something this entire time, and now they're left holding nothing at this point.
Yeah, you could probably add a roller coaster to that too, and heart-wrenching and heartache and whatever else that really kind of there's this general feeling of kind of getting punched in the gut today here. It's it's different than it was in 2008 when the announcement was made that the Sonics were leaving for Oklahoma City, because at that point there was nothing tangible on the horizon that gave anyone any sort of optimism that professional basketball could potentially return here someday. Even though yesterday was a pretty swift slap across the face of getting basketball back here in the short term, there's at least this general kind of glimmer of optimism that as long as the city here remains committed to the arena plan that was agreed to, and as long as Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer stay engaged with the process of trying to get a team back here, that sometime down the road there's an eventuality that pro basketball will get back here at some point. It's just not, you know, 4 months from now, as everybody was really excited about and hoping back in January when the story first kind of broke.
Guess, Tim, my question is, what's to stop the Maloofs and Hansen to do an Al Davis?
Nothing specifically, other than I think the Maloofs are so desperate for money at this point that they are, I think they're just in a situation where they're going to cut whatever deal they can at this point and get whatever money they can, in order to kind of cut themselves from this mess. The league has kind of, in subtle ways, has kind of indicated just how much they want them looped out of the picture. And so I think there was some conversations that took place in Dallas, which were, which kind of urged them to say, okay, if this deal with the Hansen Group doesn't go down, you really need to take seriously this option of the Vivek Ranadive Group and cut what deal you can now, take your money and get lost. And so, you know, there's nothing precluding Hansen and Maloof from coming together on some sort of, you know, backroom deal that you're right, kind of turns into an Al Davis sort of situation. But I really think they'll end up coming to some sort of agreement with the Ranadive Group and making that sell just because they need the money.
I know this has been talked about ad nauseum over the course of this process, but do you believe, Tim, at any point that this was a calculated move or risk, a posturing by the Maloofs to ultimately land where they are right now?
No, I think what it was they were opportunistic. They saw a guy in Chris Hansen and Steve Ballmer who were desperate to see basketball back in Seattle. And when Hansen and Ballmer approached them in January with what was just a ridiculous offer at that time for a franchise that was worth nowhere near that much, you know, they would have been crazy not to jump at that opportunity because of how much money they would have made just on based on the overpayment that Hansen and Ballmer were willing to make in order to try and get basketball back here. So I think it was just a case of the Maloofs trying to get as much money as they could, and the best offer that they got came from this Seattle group who was going to throw a ton of money at the situation because they had it available and they were so desperately wanting the NBA back here.
So where does that leave the arena project?
Kind of in, not necessarily in limbo. The memorandum of understanding that was agreed upon between the Hansen Group and the city and county here is good for 5 years. So it'll run through essentially 2017. The biggest step between now and the end of this year is going to be whether or not the environmental studies all come back clear for the site that they've chosen and getting that environmental study signed off by the city and the county governments here. Once that happens, my understanding is it would become very difficult for it to be overturned by any future political changes that happen here. And we have a mayoral election in Seattle coming up in the fall. And so there's some candidates who have been very supportive of the arena project. There's some candidates who have been very much against the arena project. So the big key in terms of the future of the arena is going to be getting all those environmental studies signed off on by the end of the year. Once that happens, then that 4-year window is pretty much locked in, and then it's just a matter of finding a team or getting expansion to happen sometime within that window, so that before the expiration of this agreement comes, they can get a shovel in the ground and start building the facility.
I think you understand that you're talking to people in Canada. The only reason we're asking is because we want to know if there's an arena to put a hockey team in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's hockey will never be the driving force in terms of getting the arena built. It was a talk very early on about, well, what happens if the NHL becomes the option that becomes available first rather than the NBA? And the way it seems like they have figured out the financials of how the payment for the arena works, they essentially need basketball in there first. I think the way it's been described to me is they just feel like the revenue stream is going to be more solid with the NBA to start with than hockey, and so they want to go with the more solid revenue stream at the beginning and then add hockey on later. There's a lot of hockey fans here, though, who are kind of chomping at the bit because they know, or their opinion is that this is a market that would really embrace having the NHL kind of through evidence being through the support of the junior hockey teams here in the WHL. And there's also kind of this feeling that you would have a lot of people from British Columbia, a lot of fans from British Columbia coming down to games here, even if Canadian teams weren't involved in the game, just because it's so difficult at this point to get Canucks tickets. And I know as a Canucks fan who tries to go up to Vancouver games, how difficult it is here to get tickets for their games. So there's kind of this feeling that this could be a really strong hockey market eventually, but it's been made pretty evident that basketball is going to have to be in place first before the hockey franchise comes to be.
It's interesting you say that, Tim, as well, because it makes total sense financially, John, when you think about it like that. But I guess if I'm looking at the NBA and thinking relocation, the only other city that would seem to make sense as far as relocation is Charlotte. So if it's simply then waiting for expansion, and that might not come for another 5 years, you might have a greater chance at relocation with a hockey market as opposed to having to wait out the expansion process as opposed to a relocation process.
Tim knows very well that the revenues for a hockey team at this point would certainly be minimized by a basketball team. A basketball team, the NBA, and
the cut of their national contract, especially with the new deal that's coming.
So, I mean, the hockey team would have to come second. I do know that there are some very disappointed people in the NHL office in New York about the decision yesterday.
Yeah, and I think, and you're right. I mean, the revenue stream is kind of the driving force because of how the structure was set up with arena revenues paying back the public interest or public investment into the project. So I don't have any doubt that this would be a great hockey market eventually. And I don't necessarily think that expansion is necessarily 5 years off in the NBA. I think there was a couple of indications yesterday that maybe it could be coming sooner than later, especially if the talk about the NBA already entering into the negotiations of its next national TV deal. Maybe that kind of speeds up the process. Maybe they have that next TV deal in place by this time next year, and maybe at that point, expansion becomes even more of a conversation because they'll know what their revenue streams are going to be once that TV deal kicks in 2016. So, it wouldn't surprise me if a year from now we're talking that expansion is back on the table for the NBA and Seattle is seriously in that conversation.
Tim, appreciate the time. Thanks for the insight.
No problem, guys.
There's Tim Booth, Associated Press in Seattle. We will talk about the pending retirement of David Beckham when we continue on Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet. Welcome back to Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Simulcast on Sportsnet. Eric Smith in for Bob McCowan, John Shannon, and joining us in studio, host of the Soccer Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network, Nigel Reed. Good to see you, Nigel. It came out today officially that David Beckham is stepping away from his playing days. Two more games remaining in his career. And I'll ask, will he go down as one of the greatest ever on the field or one of the greatest spokesmen ever for the game, considering where he went and where he's been representing the sport.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? He's a global ambassador for the game. There's no question about that. I don't think that he could ever have claimed to be one of the greatest players of his generation. I don't necessarily think he could ever claim to be one of the greatest players even on the teams he played for. But he had the knack. He had that wonderful right foot. He still has it. People love to poo-poo Beckham because of all the commercial activities and the underwear commercials and the colognes and so on and so forth. But we forget that, you know, underneath it all, he was just a pretty good footballer.
What did he do right?
He scored a lot of goals from free kicks in and around the area. And that put a smile on the face of a lot of fans for club and country. And the other thing he did right, John, was to help grow Major League Soccer substantially in the time he was here.
So from that standpoint, does he continue to work in some capacity in soccer? Like, what's his next step?
Well, you know, I think he could do anything he wants. The one thing I don't think he'll do is the easier question to answer. I think he has no chance of being a coach or a manager. I don't think he's cut out for that. But let's not forget, for example, he was certainly around and about and played a significant part in getting the Olympics to Great Britain in 2012. He was part of that ambassadorial bid. I mean, he's just such that he's a one-man brand, but he's a global brand. And if you get Beckham on your team, if you're bidding for something, the chances are that your chances will be enhanced.
So was it just the good looks? Honestly, because there are better players.
Partly. For sure there are better players. For sure there are better players. I mean, he played, you know, in an era when you had Figo and Zidane and countless others who were better technically players than he is. Yeah, he's a good-looking lad. He's got a nice personality. He's got pearly white teeth, and he's got a heck of a right foot. You add all that up, and that makes quite a brand.
Now, why is he deciding now?
Because he's almost as old as I am. He's 38.
But not as good looking. Come on.
Well, you know, I mean, I bet.
Okay, show your tattoos. We want to see your tattoos.
No, none of them either.
Okay.
No, sorry.
Can't help. We talked about it. We joked about it in the last hour. He retires, apparently, 7 or 8 days after Sir Alex Ferguson. And yet, in many ways, did he actually wait until Ferguson had his time in the sun, do you think? Is there something to that?
I would imagine that their respective peeps decided that they probably wouldn't announce it in the same week. But I don't think it's any great surprise that either has retired. Sir Alex had to go sometime, and eventually Fergie, eventually Bex at the ripe old age of 38, had to say, well, the mind may still be willing, but the body can't do it anymore.
I go back to what I asked a couple moments ago as well. The next step, if you had to kind of guess or theorize, the success he had here in MLS and what he did in Los Angeles, would he look to or even have a better chance to duplicate that in some sort of management or ambassador type role here on this side of the pond, or stay in Europe and do something there?
I think he will be based in Europe as far as you can base somebody like Beckham. I mean, he does a lot of traveling. He's got a zillion air miles, not that he needs them. He can give them to me if he wants. But one of the options he does actually have, which was stipulated when he was playing in MLS, is that he has an option to purchase an MLS franchise. And he has said more than once that when his playing days are done, that he intends to exercise that option. So I don't think he's done with MLS yet.
Well, would he look to hook up with his friend Tim Leiwicki and try and get a piece of Toronto FC and join the ownership of this team or the, at least the board in some capacity with Toronto
Eric,
FC?
And anything and everything is possible if you're David Beckham.
The other key thing for me is if you look at his playing career, what would you measure as, is there one specific time when he played either for England or he played for Manchester United? Is there one game that stands out?
For me personally, there are a couple, and probably for England. I mean, everybody remembers the infamous red card in the 98 World Cup. And I think part of what people tend to forget about Beckham, the Beckham bashers, if you like, tend to forget that he had great bounce-back ability. He overcame adversity after that red card in 98. He had death threats. He was persona non grata in England for at least a year after that. But he came back, that free kick against Greece, to get England to the 2002 World Cup finals. And, of course, retribution in South Korea and Japan when he scored the winning penalty to beat Argentina 4 years later.
So how do you wrap up his career overall? When you look at everything he did on and off the field, if you were writing his if you're writing it right now, David Beckham blank
golden balls, just like his wife did.
All right,
there's a tattoo somewhere on there.
but not on me.
Not on him. I'll put that on my tombstone. I might use that one. Eric Smith, golden balls, done. Go.
Mine is simpler than that, Eric.
Just balls?
I like it.
Goodbye.
I like
the cut of your jib.
Nigel Reed, host of The Soccer Show. Thanks to John Shannon.
Goodbye.
Hopefully Bob McCowan's feeling better. Eric Smith filling in for Bob McCowan. It's been Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet.